going up and down the state on a very heavy speaking schedule against Proposition 22. Why are you making such a strong stand against it? What's the matter with Proposition 22? Is it that serious?
Dick, it's a very serious proposition. The purpose of Proposition 22 is to really destroy the farm worker movement and to destroy it in such a way that will take away the rights of the workers to do basically two very important things in order to defend themselves and win contracts. One is that it takes the right to strike from us, and it also takes the right of boycotting.
Why do you need those rights? Well, what's so important about that?
Well, you see, we maintain that agriculture is different, has always been different. This is why agriculture and farm workers were never organized before. As long as we have a poor country bordering California, it's going to be very difficult to win strikes, as strikes are won normally by other unions. We don't have in agriculture a place where a determined number of people and a group of said workers work for a group of or an employer. It's a mishmash of a lot of just people working one day here and one day there and one day over there. So there's no said employer as such, you know. Also, it's relatively easy for an employer, as is the case right now in one of the strikes we have with the Butte Gas and Oil Company, where we've closed them down, then have been unable to get strike breakers, or have gotten very few. And then all of a sudden, yesterday morning, they're brought in 220 wetbacks. These are the illegals from Mexico. Now, there's no way to defend against that kind of strike breaking. And so, therefore, the only way to win strikes is by then taking our fight to the citizens, to the people in the city especially, and have them help us boycott those products that we're striking, and we need that. And that's the only way we've been able to get contracts, and I venture to say that without that, we couldn't possibly organize unions.
Well, this is then, you're saying the growers sponsored this proposition, right? And
oh, yes.
Well, for what purpose? I mean, are they trying to completely destroy the union? Or?
Sure, because you see, the employers are in trouble in one way. The only way they can go to the public and ask the public to vote to take the right to strike of farm workers and the right to boycott is by then coming around and saying that they're very concerned about the rights of workers, that workers should have the right to a free election, to a secret ballot election, and these things. Well, what's really happened is that Proposition 22 really, in its opening paragraph, really says that they're really interested in what they call the uninterrupted production, packing, processing, transporting, and marketing of agricultural products. This is their main concern, which means then that they're concerned about strikes and boycotts. Then, as an afterthought, they say that workers are free to organize. But then they go right back and take away all those freedoms that workers need to organize.
Well, how about the secret ballot elections that they talk about? What do those amount to?
The secret ballot election is... It's really fantastic. What they do is, well, they start out by saying that in order to have an election, 30% of the workers working in a given ranch have to sign an authorization card asking for an election. Then they also say that if another union is present and the other union gets 15%, they can also participate. Here's a clincher. But if neither union nor the employer gets a majority, then there is no runoff election. Contrary to the established rules of the National Labor Relations Act, that there's a second election, a runoff, if neither of two or three unions get a majority. Then the other thing is that the employers are asked by Proposition 22 to submit a list of eligible voters to the board that's created by the Proposition 22, but the board does not release that list to the union. So we don't know who's eligible to vote. We may have our own list, but the employers have a list that becomes the official list in the hands of that agricultural board appointed by Reagan with no legislative approval.
Well, what are the chances? You've been around the state now speaking. What do you see as the chances on Proposition 22? Is it likely to pass, or how's it look?
I think that an informed public would vote against it. You see, because... What has been coming through to us for many years now is that the general public really understands and is able to feel the problems of the farm workers, because our work that we do and our sacrifices and the willingness of the men, women, and children to travel and to migrate and to live in horrible shacks and to put up with all of the bad working conditions and lack of sanitary facilities and cheap wages and so forth, that men and women who work in the fields, you know, are responsible for the luscious fruits and vegetables and nuts that we eat in our tables every day. And so I think that the American public has responded to that, and we think in California is going to be the same. The problem is getting the word out to the public. That's our big problem. But we're scheduled very heavily. We have a lot of friends helping us, and we think we're going to win.
Well, yet after all these years, what's it? Your organization is now been 7 years at least. You've been at it
10 years on September 30th.
Well, why? You've gained some victory, certainly, but why have you not really been firmly established that you don't have, for instance, the legal protections that other unions have? You're still fighting things like Proposition 22.
Well, see, because we're pretty much like unions where we're in the same spot that industrial workers were in trying to organize themselves, say, in the beginning of the turn of the century and through the 20s, you know, and even through the first part of the 30s. We're not skilled workers. We don't have... there's no supply of workers. There's more workers than jobs. The workforce is pretty much like workers were 50 years ago. They're very poor. They're immigrants in many cases. They're powerless. And then we're up against an industry that is the biggest industry in California. It's the largest industry. It accounts agriculture through its work directly and indirectly affects one of every three jobs in California. It's a $4 or $5 billion industry. So these are the reasons. And then we're up against an employer community with the growers that is living at least 100 years behind their times. They have a mentality that to recognize a union would amount to losing their manhood, and they're not about to lose their manhood. And so we've got this very, very difficult mentality to deal with. And I suppose also the other reason, and I think this is a psychological reason, we're the only union made up of, or the leadership of the union made up of entirely brown and black leadership. And our membership reflects that. There's some white farm workers, but very, very small number. So I think that the employers also have a difficult time adjusting to having brown people and black people and coming, you know, and assuming leadership. Particularly in all our cases, all of us have been farm workers. And I think psychologically, they resent that very, very much. That's why in some cases they want to look to other unions to come in. And
do you feel that you've reached the point where you're established, that you're here to stay, or is it still a day-to-day precarious thing?
No, it's still a day-to-day precarious thing. It's difficult because we don't have a strike fund yet. We don't have a legal department that is established legal department. We don't have a research department that can give us the information we need. We don't have the money to do those things. We still depend on contributions to run the union. The dues are not yet enough to run it. But the spirit, you know, and the fear of the employers is practically gone. We've accomplished some very tremendous things. We don't have a union as yet. We're struggling very hard, and we think we will. But we've been able to accomplish probably one of the greatest things is that we've been able to break certain myths. First of all, there was a great myth before when we started organizing that the growers were so strong that they would never sign contracts. Well, we broke that myth. Then there was a myth that the workers are migratory and they wouldn't come together. That's been broken. And then there was also a myth that was established in the arguments in the Congress when the farm workers were excluded from the Wagner Act, and that was that somehow farm unions could not possibly be viable in agriculture. And we're saying all those things are possible. But still we're met with that awful wealth from the agricultural community, their tremendous political influence, and we're a young group, you know, we're...
It sometimes seems that you're fighting to stand still. I think of the strike you're waging right now, the big one that you're waging now, with the ranch that once was... That was the big one at the beginning, wasn't it? It was once the Shenley Ranch. That was the first contract you signed, and now you're back there fighting there, and I recall you lost the DiGiorgio contract because DiGiorgio went out of business. That was your second big one, I guess. But you're still... Well, you still feel you're viable. You're still still in there, but why have you managed to hang on this long and be successful where, you know, as you know, there were many attempts before that failed? What is the secret of your success?
Well, I just wanted to go back to the DiGiorgio question. See, DiGiorgio went out of business.
Yeah, go ahead. We got on tape.
How much? You gotta go ahead.
Oh, sure.
How much time?
We have a half an hour if you want.
The DiGiorgio question. See, DiGiorgio went out of business, but those properties are still under contract. It was a transfer, and we got him back, and we have every single inch of land that he had. He's now under contract with various employers. With the White River Farms, it used to be the Shenley, which was, in fact, our first contract. Shenley late last year, sold its interest to an outfit. It's known as the Buttes Gas and Oil. Now, Buttes came up for contract negotiations, and the contract expired on August the 28th. They wouldn't sign a contract. And it's very simple. See, John Beretta, who is the chairman of the board, wants to be the hero of the new drive among agriculturalists to put us out of business. What he's doing, he's taking a strike, and the strike is a very simple, the issues are very simple. We had asked that the White River Farms, owned by Buttes Gas and Oil, raise its wages to the level of other wine growers in the area. We've got Christian Brothers, and we have the Hugh Blind people, and we have even a small operation like Torelli Manetti with contracts with wages higher than Shenley. So we said, we want you to raise them up to that level. Then he cried all over the place, and so knowing that in order to get those wages we'd have to strike, we went back to the members, and they agreed that we would give them a 20 to 35 cents an hour less. And when once we gave into that, then he came back and he says, well, the language that we've been, that ranch has lived with for 6 years, now he didn't like the language. Then we had also made up a request. They owned 25,000 acres. And we said, look, there's other ranches that are not organized. We want in this contract to bind you to give us a recognition procedure, a secret ballot election, a card check, whatever it may be. But you're bound in this contract to give us elections or a way of the workers determining whether they want the union or not in the other ranches. He wouldn't do that. He wouldn't do it because he says, we're very poor, the ranch is losing money. We said, what does that do with the workers' right to vote?
What sort of outfit is this? Are they farmers?
It's a scabby outfit. No, they're not farmers. See, they're involved in other... What they're doing, see, they're the ones, one of the group that starts this lawyer-doctor farming business. What they have plots of land with different corporations, and they buy land, and then they sell to, say, maybe 100, 200, or 300 people, and shares, or say, equal, or parts. In other words, they don't become stockholders, they become part owners. In this way, then, they can use the tax gimmicks, you know, to evade taxes and so forth. And what they're doing now is that they have literally hundreds of people, especially from the East Coast, who invest in this land. They're part-time growers, in New York City as an example, administered supervised by the Buttes Gas and Oil Company. And so, in fact, you know, it's a very large corporation, and I think that the Congress should begin to look into that kind of a tax dodge, because not only are they coming and taking a tax break, but these are the groups that don't want to pay equal wages to workers.
Well, let me ask you again about the... Why you think you've been able to do what you've done, your organization, and others have failed in the past. What's the difference?
I think there are two great differences. One is that we've been able to enlist the tremendous support from the farm workers. We've developed in them a spirit of solidarity and a real desire to battle, you know, for justice, and a very, very strong following. Then we've gone to the cities, and we've done the same thing with large numbers of our friends throughout the country, from the religious community, from the labor community, from the liberal community, from the students, from the ethnic groups, to support us in what we're doing. And in this way, we've been able to be successful. But without the support from the cities, they would destroy us in no time flat.
Well, why did you personally start? Why were you interested in this?
Well, Dick, you know, I was a farm worker and consider myself to be a farm worker for many years prior to beginning the organization of the union. With a lot of faith and with very little experience in labor organizing, because we had spent a lot of time in community organization, and that's what I knew best. But I applied some of the techniques that we learned in 10 years prior to organizing, beginning the Farm Workers Union, and they paid off.
Well, how did you learn these techniques? What did you do before you got into the farm worker movement?
I was a farm worker, and then in early 1952, I came in contact with the Community Service Organization, the CSO, which was being organized in Los Angeles, which was now spreading to other parts of California. And they came into San Jose, where I was working on a farm, and I came in contact with them through my parish priest. And I joined them. We were doing voter registration. And I liked the idea. I could see the connection between voter registration and getting some things for us in the barrio where I lived in San Jose. And I started off with them that way. And I was so committed to the work, you know, that soon after that they needed another organizer, someone to train. So Fred Ross, who was the director and working for the CSO, he was working for Sol Alinsky at the time, hired me, and he trained me. Contrary to public, you know, to what the public thinks, I was not trained really by Alinsky. Although I worked with him, I was really trained by Fred Ross, and I paid attention to what he did, how he did things. I really wanted to learn how to organize, and I think I learned my lesson. I had 10 years under him. So when I came to organize farm workers, I had a lot of confidence.
Well, why did you leave the CSO?
Because, first of all, when I joined the CSO, one of the first things that I asked Fred Ross was, will working in the CSO organize farm workers into a union? And he thought that if the CSO got strong enough that we could do it. But I found out after 10 years that they couldn't do it. That it was really impossible to have a community service organization based mostly in a city setting to really take on the job of organizing farm workers, because it was just too much. You know, they would have to give up all the other programs to do it. And so I couldn't get them to change their mind. So I left. No, not bitter or anything. I just left because my own mind, I felt that they wouldn't be able to do it. They could have done it if they wanted to, but they had too many programs to give up if they were going to. So I brought that experience. I learned in the CSO, I learned to read and write, and I learned to organize. I learned a lot of things. Because see, when I joined the CSO, I was working in an apricot orchard, getting, as I recall, 48 and a half cents an hour then. And so I put myself through school. That was my school. But Fred Ross trained me.
Well, what about the labor movement itself? Have you learned anything from being
yes.
with them?
I have. I've learned, you know, what I learned just by being a Chicano, you know. I've learned that when someone condemns a whole group for the action of someone that one particular member of the group has committed, that it's as wrong, you know. So I learned that in the labor movement, there's an awful lot of people in the labor movement, in the lower ranks, dedicated men who don't get any public credit for what they do, but who are very dedicated, and that's what keeps the wheels of labor moving. And we also learned by meeting many of them that they're really dedicated, and that a lot of the criticism at labor that is fashionable today is not really deserved. It may be deserved in some instances, but right down at the local union level, there's tremendous human beings that don't have a heck of a lot. We learn from them tremendously.
Have you gotten, are you getting, how much support are you getting specifically? Are there unions that are putting in particular amounts of money to the drive?
Yes, the National FL-CIO gave us a charter in February and cut off the help that they were giving us. So we've existed since then from contributions from local unions, contributions from international unions, for instance, just mentioning one, but there are many. During my fast in Arizona, the AFSCME, the American Federation State, County, Municipal Employees gave us a contribution of $48,000, which is a very large contribution. But several years ago, I went to the Butchers Convention in San Diego, and we collected about $100,000 in a floor collection and a pledge. The auto workers have contributed hundreds of thousands of dollars throughout the, and at the risk and danger of leaving some of the others out, I'd say that most of the international unions have given us contributions, and a good many of the locals. What we have is we have a lot of local unions contributing $5, $10, $15, $20, $30, $50 a month. But also, the spirit, we're in a very basic struggle, and every labor union guy knows that when we're talking about recognition, you're really talking about the guts of the union. We're not striking for a wage increase or for a pension fund. We're striking for the very elemental things of labor, and that they understand very well, and we get tremendous support from them. Also, I might mention that the Canadian labor movement has been tremendous support. So has the some of the European unions in England and Germany, in the Scandinavian countries especially. So we've had our share of support.
Well, nonviolence has always been a main tenet of the movement, correct? Is it still? I mean, how do you struggle in a world where there are very few nonviolent movements left?
Because, you see, nonviolence is more powerful than violence. And it's, you know, once we are able to understand that and accept it and experiment with it and be successful with it, it's not difficult to keep. In the beginning, we had some difficulty because we're in a world where we've been struggling just before we won the contract was 58 and a half months, and most of our friends told us that it couldn't work, that we had to commit violence in order to make it work. And at that time, at that point, it was still so much hope and faith that it would work, you know. But since July, last day of July of 1970, we know it works. And we were able to beat the grape industry. And we're doing the same thing with the lettuce industry, and we're going to beat them too. Get them to understand that the works have a right to sign a contract. So nonviolence is very powerful. And also, it doesn't put a time limit on you. And it doesn't take you off of your main objective. We've seen in our own day, in the last few years, where very good groups with very high ideals and goals, you know, somehow got detracted from the course of nonviolence and became involved in violent action. And all that happened was that the focus was taken away from the problems of the people, and then they were focused on people in jail and all of the other things that come as a consequence. And society is not set up in this country, especially in this country with its heavy Anglo-Saxon traditions. They're not equipped to deal with nonviolence. They don't understand fasting. They don't understand sacrifice. But we're teaching a lot of them, and we find out that they like that. And now they're equipped to deal with violence.
Well, haven't you had a problem with some of your own members, though, teaching them as well? Hasn't there been some frustration, at least?
Oh, sure. But the power of nonviolence is not in winning the contract or winning the boycott. The power of nonviolence really rests on the reservoir that you have to create in yourself of patience. Not of being patient with the problems, but of being patient with yourself to do the hard work. Also, nonviolence assumes that the organizer has tremendous resources in terms of confidence and know-how, and is able to shift and to move and to create. You got to have a tremendous creativity in order to be nonviolent, because nonviolence, erroneously, and the worst thing is that people think that nonviolence is a shortcut to where they're going, and it isn't, and that's a trap. And we say in nonviolent work that you can't be trapped. So you have to be an organizer, you have to be confident, you have to be resourceful, creative, and have patience and time. See, we say time really does for us what money does for the employer. Time is our greatest asset.
How much time? I recall 1965, one night talking to you over a red desk, top desk in Delano, and we were asking how long, and you didn't know how long then. How long do you think now?
Our lifetime. But we've done some good things. We've got we have a medical plan that's paid, is going to pay a little over $1 million this year to farm workers for health benefits, and that's in our estimation, that's a near miracle. We've got two medical clinics. We have a medical clinic in Delano. We started after 10 years of planning and working, trying to get the plan and the clinic in actual operation. It's the best clinic anywhere in the valley, and we say that the farm workers in Delano, they belong to the union there, most of them do, get better medical care than the presidents of the three local banks. Because we have 24-hour service, we have young doctors who are really committed to people, and then we have another clinic in Calexico, and we're now organizing one in Fresno and one in Salinas. Then we have contracts and members, and we do have a movement, and it's a very strong, it's getting stronger, even though there's a lot of opposition. But we also have a lot more friends in the cities, particularly San Francisco, which is a very good city. It's always been good to us, and I think generally to labor.
Well, do you include the growers among your friends, the growers who you've signed contracts with? How do you get along with the grape growers, for instance, after all those years of fighting them?
Well, I don't talk with the growers. I don't fight them, but I don't become their personal friends. I have my time is spent with the workers and with the. I spend most of my time with the workers and with the people in the cities, with the supporters, and other people do the have to do that work, which I don't like and I don't appreciate. But I don't want to place myself in a position where I've become a great friend of an employer and then for I can't fight him later on. I'm not about to do that. But similarly, we don't. I'm not saying that. Once they sign a contract and they want to work with the workers and they want to live up to the contract, we'll also live up to our obligations. But in the same hand, if they don't, we'll also fight them even though we have a contract. And that's one of the great fears among the grower community is that that we don't hesitate to fight them if they fight us back. See, they don't understand that our word is gold, you know. When we give someone our word, we'd rather die than break our word. And when they make a promise, they better keep that promise, otherwise they're going to have problems from us. And so more and more employers are finding out how we work. They're finding out that if they keep their word, what we agree to, if they keep that word, that then they'll have our word. But the moment they try to cheat on the contract, they're going to have problems with us.
What do you see as your... What is your goal, the goal that you're shooting for? A hiring halls all over the state, or what sort of a setup?
No, I think that we're not... See, contracts and hiring halls and medical plans and clinics, all those are things that are fine things. No, we're involved in something different. I think that what we're really saying is that the basic element, the thing that makes us do what we're doing is people, the workers. And so we say that although better wages are important, working conditions are important, all these things, that the most important thing, really, is to have the worker truly become and understand and know that he's free, that he's a free man, that he can stand up and cross the bargaining table or anywhere where he feels, he can get up and say how he feels and why and complain. In other words, bringing back the dignity that he lost as a free man. If we can make the farm worker free, the poverty and the deprivations and all the things that come with it will be a little easier to withstand. Because his own freedom is going to then get the other things that he needs in life, the material things. But I think that's a spiritual thing to begin with. I think that when we speak of freedom, we speak really mostly of having the freedom of spirit, you know, and that developing that freedom, that then they'll take care of themselves. And we're seeing it today when a group of workers get organized. They don't stop there. No, once they get organized, they have a contract, they begin to think about politics, about buying a home, about buying a car, sending their kids to school. And it's an explosion that goes, it's a great ripple that's created, you know? And that's what we're after. Just get that process started. And we're doing it. We're doing it in many, many places.
Well, how do you relate your movement to the other Chicano movements, some of the... La Raza Unida, for instance, and others who have been critical, of course, of your movement. How do you relate
well,
to them?
Well, basically, we're in agreement with them. There is a great need not only with the Chicanos, but with the blacks and with all minority groups in this country, of exploitation and injustices and lack of work and education, all of those things. Now, and even the Raza Unida Party, you know, I think it's a good thing. Now, what they're doing, but they're just a couple of things that we disagree, you know, with. And number one is that we cannot be a Chicano union, because we comprise about 30% of the workforce in the United States as Chicanos. Secondly, in the West Coast, we're the biggest group. So we have to be careful, because with the majority, that we don't act as a majority against the other groups. Also, see, there's a lot of, like in the Filipino community, as an example, in the Arab community, there was a lot of Arab workers in the union. Almost any time that there's an article that implies that the union is a Chicano union, our Filipino brothers will come up and say, why do they say those things? What about the Filipinos? The Arabs will come and say, what about us, the blacks? And so in our own minds, in our own leadership, we are primarily an economic movement. We're made up of many groups. We have right now 6 or 7 different ethnic groups, so much so that in most meetings it has to be done in 2 languages, if not in 3 and 4. And we are extremely happy. Problem of understanding. We're invited many times to participate in many Chicano affairs, and lack of understanding on the part of some of our Chicano brothers that we are up to our necks day and night. We work every day of the year, holidays, Christmas, New Year's, every single day, and we work a schedule of from 12 to 14, 16 hours a day. And the pressure from the workers, and just the pressure defending ourselves from the employers, is so great that we have very little time to go anywhere. We had hoped that in the near future we'll be able to do that, and we like to. It's very relaxing to be able to go to a black affair or Chicano affair and break bread with them and be with them. It's relaxing. But it's a luxury at this point. It's extremely difficult to do it.
Well, one other thing, what about the Teamsters Union? How are you getting along with them?
Okay, when we say the Teamsters Union, I think to really clarify it, because by and large, the Teamsters Union throughout the country, and when you get down to the local level, they're unionists. And we can't confuse the issue that they're a union, we're a union, and we can't fight one another. There may be disagreements and there may be even occasions where we have to battle, but that's is not to say that we have to confuse the issue and battle among ourselves and forget about the employers. Secondly, it's only an element within the Western Conference that wants to be piggish and hoggish, and they want to take all the workers. They're having problems because it's a very unpopular cause right now to oppose us, but it's also a very unfair thing for them to do, to ally with the employers to do us in, you know, like in the Salinas question. And secondly, they can't win because, see, we don't measure a success in terms of how much money we have in the bank. Our strength comes from the spirit of the people and being able to get them in action. And so if the team should stay out of the field, fine. If they go into the field, we'll fight them. Like we fought them several times before and we won, and we'll continue to win. And it's a disservice to their members, and of course a disservice to justice to try and do what they did in Salinas. I don't think they're going to do it, but if they do it, we'll fight them.
Are you going to try to get back all the contracts in Salinas, or get contracts with the growers who now have contracts with the Teamsters?
Well, it's a very curious thing. They don't really have contracts. No one's been able to see those contracts. And secondly, when the pressure is put on an employer, they're very willing to sign with us, and they forget about the Teamster contracts. So in fact, there aren't any contracts. The employers are using that. They're saying that they have contracts only as a way of... That's the only defense they have. But we'll get to them, and they'll sign contracts with the union, and we'll establish a union. But if we have to fight with the Western Conference or the leadership of the conference or a few people in the conference, we'll do it. I mean, we're not afraid of it. We only have one thing to do. That's organize farm workers.
What about outside California? You ready to move over there?
Yeah, we have organizing drives in Oregon, Washington, Idaho, Utah, Colorado, Arizona, Florida, New York. And we're now speaking with some of our Puerto Rican friends from the East Coast who are organizing there, and we're trying to assist them and help them develop an organization over there of Puerto Rican farm workers. We went to Florida and we organized. In less than a year, we were able to get 2 contracts, one with the Coca-Cola company and one with Hood. HP Hood. And in that contract, what's really, really great is that when we went to Florida, we were told by everybody that the Black Brothers would not respond to us because we were a Chicano union. And so we were worried, and I sent my brother, which I think is one of the best organizers in the union, they're workers, they're responding like any worker, and they gave us tremendous support. We have now about 3,500, and they're in step with what we're doing, and we're very proud of that.
That's right. Okay, thank you very much. Okay.